Welcome to the Education Finance Committee, everyone. Committee will come to order. And let's see, Representative Dabney, have you had an opportunity to review the minutes?
Clearly, Madam Chair, and I'd move their adoption.
All right. Any questions or comments? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes from March 15th, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All right. Any opposed? Minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Dabney. All right. So we today are very pleased to welcome Commissioner Caselius to present the governor's supplemental budget recommendations. And, of course, they were released on
Friday.
And so fortunately, we have her here to present those recommendations to the committee, and I understand that she will take questions as well. Very good. So, all right. Welcome, Commissioner. Great to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for having me. Brenda Caselius, Commissioner of Education. I'm really happy here to present the governor's budget, and like the governor likes to say when we're at pressers, I'll take the easy questions and leave the hard questions for Dr. Melcher and Mr. Uni here, who are with me. I'll try the hard questions, and then if you can't do it, then I'll turn to the experts here, especially Tom on the technical parts of the levies. So the governor's budget, I think you'll see, is not very different than the past seven budgets. As you know, the governor put out his seven-point plan. He stayed pretty stable with his priorities throughout his two terms around early learning, around more funding for schools, around additions for special education, and around equity funding for American Indian students and such. And so I kind of want to go through some of those investments and in this supplemental budget for you to think about as you prioritize your bill coming up. So just as an overview, we're going to talk about the really important need for safe schools. As you know, this morning, even just this morning, we had another school shooting in the nation, and hopefully that this body and our body in the Senate, we can come together and do something around helping secure our schools and to create safe environments. So you'll see some recommendations there under the Governor's Safe Schools Act. Some of that is policy with our Pupil Fair Dismissal Act, and some of that is actual funding. Our special education funding increase looks at some corrections and some technical modifications that Dr. Melcher will bring you through, as well as some funding to buy down the cross-subsidy pre-kindergarten and other early education programs to support our earliest learners, American Indian education, assessments, long-term facilities maintenance, and referendum local optional revenue clarifications, QCOMP adjustments, regional library telecommunications aid, and a few other proposals that I'll go through. I'll try to go rather quickly, and if you could give me the time, I will go through these quickly and then take questions at the end if that would work for folks, because some of these you may have questions for Dr. Melcher. I just don't want to go back and forth in the technical nature of it, so I'll try to do a broader, more brief proposal on each of these, and then we'll take questions afterward if that would work for the chair.
Yes, that would work very well. And members, if you do have a question, just signal us and we'll keep a list.
And you should have the handout as well, so hopefully you have that. So the first one is really talking about the Safe Schools Act that the governor proposed, looking at increasing within this committee, and not talking too much about the policy here, just the financial pieces that he's recommending is increasing and equalizing the Safe Schools Levy to improve student and safe and secure schools. That would ask for $15.9 million one-time state aid to get out to districts and charters so that they could get started on these projects, and then $18 per pupil. And then in FY20 and thereafter, ongoing funding and double and equalized levy allowance and give aid to teachers. And you can see those amounts down below. We think that there's pretty broad bipartisan support to do something on the levies. This is the approach the governor is proposing. I know in the Senate they have a grant type of program that they're proposing. The only problem with the grant type of program is that what do we do when the money runs out if there's not additional way to get revenue for schools. So I like this proposal better. And then we don't have in here, but we've heard from our intermediates and our co-ops that they also would like to have adjustments to their to be able to access the Safe Schools levy as well. So we'd like to address intermediates and co-ops as well. Special ed funding, which Dr. Melcher will go through in depth a little later, is about reducing the special ed cross-subsidy. As you know, it's has grown from about $600 million in FY14 to about $687 million in FY17, and is projected to increase to $847 million. So this won't get rid of the cross-subsidy, but it will help to reduce the growth in the cross-subsidy. And we're requesting $16.9 million in FY19, $21.4 million in FY20, and $22 million in FY21. And then we have come to the governor's pre-kindergarten proposal. As you know, we have no longer argue about the importance of early learning for our youngest Minnesotans. However, the approach, I think, has been something that we have really heavily debated in this committee and negotiated in our bills. And what we are just asking for is to continue to honor the agreement we made last session for those school districts who are in the additional $25 million a year of either school readiness or VPK of their choosing. That they then would not have to stop offering that to their communities, and that because they've gone through a lot of work to establish these preschool programs, and without that funding being ongoing, many of our school districts, I think it's 70 districts, would have to stop offering the pre-K, VPK, or school readiness. And so we're asking for that. And then part of that is also to increase in outgo years by 5% beginning in FY20. So that is just kind of on an automatic growth to give increased opportunity for other schools to opt into school readiness plus or VPK, whatever was their choosing. Other early education changes that we would make, one is revenue neutral, which would be to expand our scholarships 0 to 3. As you well know, the earlier we start with scholarships, especially targeted scholarships for low-income children, the better off they are. And so we think it's wise policy, fiscal policy, to start earlier with our kids. So letting 0 to 3-year-olds use scholarships. Currently, 0 to 3-year-olds can for teen moms, but this would expand to everybody. Help Me Grow is $1.5 million per year. This would be mostly to work with creating the data systems in order to do the referral services, and would work out of our children's cabinet. And then we have background checks for Head Start. This is also revenue neutral. The Head Start's programs are license exempt and aren't receiving CCAP funds, and tribal Head Start programs need to be added to the list of programs that can use DHS background studies. So this would be a provision for greater access of CCAP funding and for the licensing so that we can have background checks at Head Start. And then one smaller provision is to align kindergarten hours for those with a disability with all kindergarten students. The next one is American Indian Education Initiatives. As you know, our tribal contract aid was put in place in, I think, the last time it was changed prior to this previous equalization was in 1989, almost 30 years ago, to do equalization. And that was capped at about $1,500. And then we did, when all of the reports came about the bug school and the inequities there of that facility, we dug a little deeper and found out that they were actually getting a lot less funding than the average per pupil that every other Minnesota kid got. So this body stepped up and funded them at this average per pupil cost. And that's about $1,820 per pupil. We've done that for two sessions now. And if we don't make that ongoing, that's going to be a real cut to those students at our four BIE schools. And so that's very important to me and the governor that we continue our commitment to our American Indian students who are attending tribal contract schools. The Minnesota Indian Education Teacher Training Program changes. This is not any new funding. It's really just to clarify partnerships within the teacher training program. And getting clear direction to the current grantees about the institutions that they can partner with, and clarify scholarship eligibility, and eliminates the loan portion of the program. Moving on to assessments, access, and in efficiency, we'd like to fully fund taking the GED. One really great statistic is that in 2015, when the GED changed to college and career readiness standards, they saw a huge decline in the numbers of adults and young people who had dropped out of school taking the GED, and to about 10,000 a year. Then we were able to, because we had some additional WIA funding, we were able to give the GED for free, and we saw 18,512 individuals take the GED. And then it dipped again after we ran out of money, back down to 13,660. So it's very clear that the fee is a barrier for some people to take the GED. So as we expand the GED and maybe other college equivalency tests, we'd like to be able to give this give it to them for free. This would cost just $400,000 per year in this budget. So, and it would cover roughly 5,000 new testers. So I think that's really important to do. Another one is to extend the time for districts to seek reimbursement for the college entrance exam. This is really just a matter of timing of when the test is given throughout the year and when districts get reimbursed. So this is kind of a technical change, but we had to just run it through the fiscal committee. And then we have proposed this a few years in a row to eliminate off-grade test questions to shorten the MCA test, and also the career college and readiness scores. These come from our OLA report. These are recommendations from the OLA, and we're bringing them forward as items that we agree with the OLA that would streamline our testing protocols and shorten the time that students take exams. We think there'd be about a $15,000 cost reduction with that. Then we move into long-term facilities maintenance and referendum local optional revenue changes, which Dr. Melcher will discuss with you. But what it generally does is allow certain cooperating districts to equitably spread the levy for safety projects. Agreements for the secondary education or inter-district cooperation agreements would be included. It covers revenue generated by indoor air quality, fire safety, or asbestos projects in the long-term facilities maintenance levy. And then with the referendum, local optional revenue clarification, as you know, we came back with Owatonna a few years ago, had to make that very large adjustment and correction, and we've had a few other districts that have had difficulty with the language on the ballots with these, and so this simplifies the referendum revenue and also converts $300 per pupil of referendum revenue to local optional revenue. Then we came into a problem with QCOMP now that we're at the cap. We've had charter schools that have grown or expanded, as we have our charter replication grants from the U.S. Department of Education, and you'll have them expand, and one of their programs is in QCOMP and the other isn't, so there's an equity issue, or there's been enrollment changes at a school, and so because this is generated on a per pupil, when a school district grows, then we're hitting the cap, and the only choice we have, there's no additional funding, is to prorate across all QCOMP and do a reduction, or to lift the cap so that we can make those adjustments for enrollment. Currently, right now, that would cost about $847,000 in FY19. and 1.4 in FY20 and 1.7 million in FY21 because we anticipate that the student enrollment is also going to grow across these districts. It does not lift the cap in such a way that new programs would be allowed to go in, though, because that would be much more expensive. Transfer of regional library telecommunications aid to telecom equity aid. This is really kind of a technical fix to allow us to convert some unspent funding based on efficiencies at $350,000 each biennium. So the librarians just want to be able to use this new aid based on efficiencies that they were able to create because of new technologies, and this would give them the flexibility to do that. Currently, let me just share this. I may get this as a question, so I want to anticipate it. We have about 22 districts and charters that are currently waiting on the QComp wait list. $7 million would be needed in FY19, $8 million in each of the two out years to fully fund those 22 districts. I know this has been an interest of yours, Madam Chair, in the past. 12 of the waiting lists are outside the 7-county metro area. And then there's just a few other governor proposals that are not in the Ed Bill that I wanted to bring your attention to that I think really speak to the overall comprehensive nature of the governor's requests and what we've seen in the past. The first is around pensions, and it seems like there's a lot of bipartisan support around the Pension Commission and the work that they've done around covering some of these pension costs. There would be $10.8 million in FY19. $23.8 million in FY20 and $35 million in FY21, but it's carried not in this, but in the pension bill. I'm not sure how it will end up being carried, but currently it's not in the governor's recommendations, but it is in the pension side of things. Then school-linked mental health. Madam Chair, I've heard you speak strongly about in support of school-linked mental health grants. The governor is also proposing $5 million per year. This would... we serve currently, I think, 1,000 schools with what the effort is we've already been doing with DHS, and about 11,000 students. So I believe this would double that effort. And then just a really small program that was innovative that we piloted several years ago and we continue to support. It's called Homework Start at Home through our housing department. We all know that stable housing is absolutely necessary for students to be successful in school. And so this is $4 million in FY19 to help provide stable housing for an additional 500 families and about 1,000 students. So those are the recommendations. Of course, that housing bill is carried in the housing, in housing bill. So now we'd be open for questions.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner. I'm going to hold my questions until after other members have had an opportunity, but Representative Wills, you had a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Castillas, for being here today. I did have a couple of questions, and maybe it would be for your experts, but feel free to answer as well. On page 5 or slide 5, special education funding, I was just wondering if you could provide more explanation of what improving the formula calculation looks like and how that would change. And then it mentions we are lifting the per pupil cap. I'm just wondering, is that there would be no cap at all, or does it just increase? If I could have some more explanation on those 2 points.
Madam Chair and Representative Wills, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. The recommendations would include a couple of changes in the initial special ed aid calculations. I know you reviewed a spreadsheet that Mr. Strom had, and one of the three formulas that's used in the initial aid calculations is based on special education child counts and state average costs in each of the areas. And the first recommendation from the governor is to update the data used in the child count portion of the formula to reflect the most recent cost study that we do. Under Minnesota Statute 125A76, we do an annual cost study, and we would like to see that updated. And that would increase somewhat the per pupil rates for the per pupil driven portion of the formula. The governor is also recommending Instead of having the least of three different formulas, that we simplify things a little bit by eliminating the calculation based on the old formula that was repealed in 2013. And so the new formula would just be the lesser of the updated per pupil formula or the funding that's a percentage of the total cost, including fringe benefits. So again, there would be some increases for those districts that are held down because of the old formula there. In addition to that, there would be a slight increase in the excess cost formula by reducing the subtraction for the general education aid for districts that do get their funding based on the old formula. And then finally, the cap would be raised by $30. It's not a total elimination of the cap, but it would provide a $30 per pupil increase for those districts that are at the cap. And we do have a run, Madam Chair and members, for fiscal year 19, I believe, in your packets that would show the district-by-district impact. I'd be happy to walk you through that if you had time or to answer questions if you had on that.
Thank you, Dr. Meltrell. I think we'll continue with questions, and then if we need to go through that and we have time, we will. But I know that we also, once we have legislative language to introduce, we'll probably come back and hear this in detail again. So, Representative Wills?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Meltrell. That was very helpful. And my other question was on slide 10. It wasn't fine. I apologize. Nine. And Commissioner Castellas, you mentioned removing some of the questions off of the test that maybe aren't applicable. And I was just wondering if you could explain or expand on that, which questions you're looking at removing and the rationale behind it.
Commissioner.
Representative Wills, Madam Chair, it's an adaptive test, so the test gets harder for students as they take the questions, and they also get easier as they are able to take it based on their ability. So the off-grade portion was where standards are presented that are a grade or two higher than what the student is supposed to be able to demonstrate. And those questions come after they've taken all of their grade level questions. And then we just have this kind of next piece, and ELA is probably another more difficult passage than that they would have to read and answer a set of 8 to 15 questions on that passage or two passages, depending on whether they're going to assess a grade or two higher. And we would just eliminate that off grade level portion because it really doesn't relate to the grade level accountability system that we're using, and we've heard complaints from parents and students and teachers about the length of the test.
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Thank you. That was helpful to understand what you're trying to accomplish there, what the governor was proposing. And I'd have to think about that more. I don't know if that would be necessarily the best approach, because for some students that would be really beneficial to be able to see where they may be proficient beyond their grade level. So I think it'll be something that we will discuss as we see an actual bill come forward.
Commissioner.
Representative Wills, I was very supportive of off-grade level when we first got it, but we're not seeing teachers use that information as much as we thought we could, and it also is not helping us with our exam and having for the accountability pieces in terms of the alignment. So it didn't make as big of a difference as I thought it was going to make.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question in regards to page 6. It says, and I'm just wondering why the governor recommends to split out for pre-K for Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Commissioner?
Representative Peterson, Madam Chair. There was an imbalance with Minneapolis and St. Paul and the amount of scholarships and, VPK and school readiness dollars that went out to them, and they kind of work together on the distribution of that, and this is kind of to fix it for Minneapolis and St. Paul so that's a fairer distribution between the two cities.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's great. I'm glad that that work's been done. And then I believe this is on page 7. And so, you know, I was just, help me understand. I understand that there's like a waiting list for more of this early education stuff. And so why does the governor want to expand that to 0 to 3? I mean, infants, 1 and 2-year-olds?
Commissioner. Representative Peterson, Madam Chair, and members, the research is just really clear that targeted approaches work really well for younger children. And so, you know, there's a lot of folks within the health community, pediatricians, other researchers who think providing support to children birth to 3 is really advantageous and good for children academically, that waiting until age 4 might be too late.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, in doing that work, just because I've served on HHS and early childhood things as well as child care and accessibility and affordability, I think it's just important to make sure that we're working closely with DHS in that work so that we're not duplicating or at least working together so that we don't run into maybe some of the issues that happened in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Making sure that resources go to people the way they should. And then, Madam Chair, if I could, can you help explain, you know, how does the kindergarten disability hours change after alignment? I just help me understand that. Thank you.
Dr. Melcher?
Madam Chair and Representative Peterson, when the state funded all-day kindergarten, we missed an opportunity to align the way we fund the all-day kindergarten programs for children with a disability and children without a disability. So the way that the law reads right now, if you have an 850-hour all-day kindergarten program for a regular child, you get funding for one pupil unit. If you're a child with a disability, you have to have 875 hours. We think it should be the same, just like it is for kindergarten, for first grade through 12th grade. In addition, the way that the older kindergarten statute works for the children with a disability, they don't qualify for extended time programs. Kindergarten students with a disability do qualify for extended time. It would be targeted services programs at that age. And so if they're falling behind, it would seem unfortunate that the children with a disability who might need the extra help the most are the ones who don't get funded for having some extra hours. So it's a relatively small increase, $153,000, that would allow children with a disability that are kindergartners to have the same calculations done to generate revenue as other children.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hi, Commissioner and Company. I was expecting to see from page 9 the off-grade test in the policy bill. So I was wondering if I didn't show up there like it did last year, and we questioned that. So I have no problem with seeing it here. Can you better explain, though, the career and college readiness scores that you are going to eliminate? Is that the 3 through 8 that is supposed to... Okay. Got it. I mean, the rest of you may not know, but...
Yeah, maybe for the rest of us.
Maybe the commissioner should explain.
Thank you. We're in suspense now. Commissioner.
Representative Erickson, Madam Chair. The college and career readiness scores are scores that we've put out on that match to the ACT, and the OLA has recommended that it's a bit too early to start telling third graders whether they're college and career ready based on the ACT, and so we're recommending, the OLA recommended, and we agree with the recommendation that we should not be doing these, and then I'll let Adosh talk to why it's not in the policy bill.
Yeah, I want to hear
Mr. Rooney.
Madam Chair, members, Adosh Rooney, Department of Education. Always a pleasure to answer your questions. We brought this proposal forth to through the policy process, and as we were going forth, we realized under the contract that we currently have, there was work that wouldn't necessarily be done. And the amount was, as the commissioner mentioned, close to $15,000. But under our contract, we're able to reallocate that to other enhancements for testing security, for improved services, and that such. So it's a revenue-neutral proposal, but MMB made the determination that it did need to go through the budget process since there were some, even within a contract, some shifting of funds.
Thank you, Mr. Rooney.
Thank you, Mr. Rooney. Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate that explanation very much. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple things. So, as I was around that topic, it seems to me that, it sounds perhaps absurd to look at third to eighth grade in terms of college career readiness. If I remember correctly, when we first conceptualized this, ACT was putting out a series of suite of assessments that were age appropriate. And I think one of the issues is that the ACT then backed out of producing that product, which many of us thought would be a helpful early indicator, not just in terms of where a student would quote unquote end up, but serve as additional guides for a student and parents to be able to make planning. Am I wrong about that, or is that, I see you nodding that perhaps that's part of the reason as well, that those instruments simply are not there anymore?
Commissioner.
Representative Mariani, Madam Chair, I do believe you're correct in that they were planning on doing a more robust rollout with kind of this college and career readiness that didn't ever exist. But we really are making this recommendation because it was a recommendation of the OLA. So we're agreeing with some of the findings of the OLA report and moving forward with some of their recommendations.
Representative Mariani.
Well, Madam Chair, far be it for me to challenge the OLA. I have a lot of respect for them. However, I suspect that part of what guided the OLA's recommendation had to do with this issue of, quote, unquote, taking too many tests. It's been my position that the issue, quite frankly, is poorly framed, that the issue, while clearly there's a concern about, quote, unquote, too many tests, the real issue is what is the best type of assessment that we can help arm parents and students with. But that's for another discussion. I do have a quick question on number 11. This has to do with the QCOP adjustment that apparently we're now prorating because there's pupil growth happening. And I should have been paying closer attention, but did you say that the growth is all happening within charter schools?
No.
Commissioner.
Representative Mariani, Madam Chair, it's not happening just in charter schools. There is growth in all schools. But charter, I use that as an example.
Okay. All right.
Where you may have a replication of a high-quality charter school, for instance, and they're opening up another school building, or you could have within a district some rapid enrollment growth happening.
And then, Madam Chair, and this, you don't have to answer this, but just an observation that I think that there is a strong interest across the state of school districts participating in the quote-unquote QCOP program. There's a lot of good reasons for that. I would argue the primary reason is because it's serving as a wonderful peer centered way in which to enhance teacher effectiveness. And so kind of the big begging question is, why not have a recommendation for us to fund the $7 million so that we can get those 12 Greater Minnesota School District and those 10 Twin Cities School Districts into the program? And you could choose not to answer, but, you know.
No, I mean, Representative Mariani, Madam Chair, I think Dr. Sure. Spencer wanted to share a technical piece, and then I will answer your question.
Thank you.
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, I just wanted to point out that in the last enrollment forecast, we did see enrollment growth not only in charter schools but in school districts as well. And for fiscal year 19 in the current budget forecast, we're prorating at 98.8% and at 98.3% in fiscal 20 and at 97.8% in fiscal year 21. And the way that the QCOMP law is written, what that does is it shifts funding from state aid to property taxes. The school districts still qualify for the $260 per enrolled student, but they get less in the way of state aid and more in the way of property taxes. So the change would just make the formula whole. It would be the amount that was anticipated in terms of the aid and levy share. And we do have a few school districts that don't choose to make the levy. They go into QCOMP, they just get the state aid. So for them, it would be a small revenue increase because the proration would go up.
Thank you.
And Representative Mariani, Madam Chair, I have been in front of this committee for many sessions saying, talking about QComp equity, especially within our rural schools who were late to the QComp game, and unfortunately they're not able to get into QComp, but now they see the value in terms of, you know, school turnaround and our accountability systems and being able to access that funding for professional development for their teachers or curriculum review or standards implementation. And they they don't have the funding for it because there's no more funding to get into QComp. As you recall, Senator Stump was a real advocate for equity across all districts being able to have the same. So I hope in the future, maybe in next year's funding year, we'll be able to address QComp.
And Madam Chair, since I sort of dissed the OLA, which I'm probably going to get in trouble for because we shouldn't do that. I would say that, you know, all OLA reports in the past have pointed to and really signaled for us a new way to be thinking about QCOP beyond, you know, its original thought. And so there's some good information for members, you know, if you look back over the OLA reports in terms of multiple ways in which that program has been embraced and thought helpful in terms of enhancing teacher effectiveness. As well. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Other questions for the Commissioner? A lot of mine were covered with other member questions, so I'll look through. Is there anyone else that has a question right now? And I'm going to look quickly at my notes because there were a couple things. Oh, I know. On the long-term facilities maintenance program and then the conversion of the $300 per pupil referendum revenue to local optional revenue. Could you go over that for me once again, or Dr. Melcher, just so I'm clear about that?
Madam Chair and members, on the long-term facility maintenance program, the governor's recommendation is to allow school districts that are in a pairing agreement to split the levy for large projects between the two districts that are involved in a pairing agreement. So these occur, I think there are about 10 districts in the state that are involved in these. It's typically one very small district that's closed their high school and they send all the kids to the other school. So the situation that could come up, we haven't had it come up yet, is that the larger school, let's say, has a big asbestos project. And they're gonna be billing the small school that sends all of their high school kids there for part of that cost. So what this would allow is for the school districts to split the levy for that purpose on some fair basis that they determine locally so that they each have the dollars to fund their share of that cost. We currently do this for the Career Tech program for school districts that are in a pairing arrangement where one district is sending all their high school kids to the other one and the other one offers the program. We let them split the levy so that the levy burden isn't all on the one district.
Okay.
The other one dealing with the referendum and local optional revenue is an issue that's gone back since the 2013 session. You'll recall that came up late in the tax conference committee, and we've had a fair amount of confusion about the referendum calculations ever since. You'll recall in 2015 we had Owatonna come in for special legislation because they were confused about the subtraction that comes off of referendum for local optional, and they ended up shorting themselves. I think it was roughly $1 million. We've had a few other situations like that. Most recently, we heard about the Foley School District this year, where they didn't short themselves on any revenue, but they unintentionally asked for $424 per pupil of local optional revenue, which then got subtracted from their Tier 1 referendum, and so the bottom line is they got the revenue they were expecting, but they ended up levying $60,000 more in taxes and getting $60,000 less in state aids just because of confusion about how the two fit together. So we are recommending a change that would take the $300 per pupil of the referendum revenue that is available to districts by board approval rather than by referendum. We think it's kind of misplaced by calling that referendum when there's no referendum required to get the money and just say we'll have a $724 per pupil local optional revenue. We would move the equalization, that first year equalization, to local optional, so there would be no change in aid and levy. And then rather than having the districts each year tell us how much local optional they want, and then have us subtract it off of the referendum. So the referendum's going up and down depending on what they decide. We would just say the referendum allowance is reduced by the $424 of local optional, which almost every district in the state currently takes, and we would avoid a lot of unnecessary paperwork and have a little more straightforward system that reduces the potential for situations like Foley and Owatonna from happening in the past, and it would not have any fiscal impact on any district. It would just make it a lot easier for districts to operate.
I think whatever you could do, if we could make that much clearer in the statute, it would be much appreciated by school districts and those of us on the Education, Finance, and Tax Committee. So, anyway, good suggestion. Other questions? All right. I'm not seeing any. So, with that, thank you very much, Commissioner, Dr. Melcher, and Mr. Uni. Appreciate you being here. And, again, we may have you back again when there's legislative language or to go through specifics at a later time. Thank you so much. All right, we have several bills that we're going to hear today. So I think Representative Punish-Padin, if you are here, I'll have you start off. And while you're coming forward, I will move House File 3361 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee, but it is my intent today to lay over the bill for possible inclusion in an omnibus or action at a later time. And welcome. If you please just state your name so we have that for the record.
Sure. I'm Representative Mary Kunish-Podine. I want to thank you for letting us be here this afternoon and share this with you.
All right. Thank you so much. We're very pleased to have you and your testifiers.
All right. This afternoon, we are presenting to you a bill around opioid and substance abuse. This very lovely woman next to me came to me last year and shared her very sad story about losing her son to opioids. And she had already begun a foundation called For Jake's Sake Foundation, and had been very active in the communities around sharing her situation and what they had been through, and realized it was really important that we got the message into our schools, much like we did the tobacco, anti-smoking, and say no to drugs and that sort of thing. So we have here today Sherry Schumaus, who is the mother of Jake, Carla Peterson, who really is the For Jake's Sake Foundation person, and then we have Bailey Belter from the Minnesota Youth Council, and we heard this in education policy, thank you, and would like to share a little bit about this whole program that we have put together for you. Sherry.
All right, thank you, and welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and Representatives. My name is Sherry Schmaus. I'm Jake's mom. We lost Jake on May 22, 2013, to a heroin overdose. Our lives were forever changed that day. The devastating loss of Jake is with us every day. Jake's dad found him on the floor of his bedroom, and he tried to revive him and give him CPR, but it was too late. Our beautiful son was gone. My husband has to live with that every single day, and no parent should have to go through this. Let me tell you about Jake. He was kind. He was sweet. He was compassionate, loyal. He was very smart, very athletic. He was good-looking, funny, and a wonderful son, brother, and friend. He had beautiful blue eyes and a smile that lit up the room when he walked in. And Jake also loved to hunt, fish, go four-wheeling, play video games, play cards, go camping, play basketball, skateboarding, swimming, and he loved to watch sports with his brother and dad. He also loved to shop. And Jake had a certain style about him. He always had to look perfect, just so. And he loved the girls, and the girls loved Jake. And he wrote for the school paper. He played on the varsity basketball team. As he graduated from St. Francis High School, it seemed as if possibilities were endless for this fantastic life Dave could have. And then we found out in August 2012 that he was a heroin addict. Our lives forever changed that day. We were heartbroken. We couldn't believe that this could be Jake. He had so many positive and good strengths. Jake was an inpatient and outpatient after that, and he was clean for 60 days before the evil drug of heroin took his life. Jake died in May of 2013, so just a few months after we learned he had an addiction. Jake told me he was a prisoner in his own body. He also said that he did not know how evil this drug was and how addictive the drug was, and it took over his body. He once said to me, "Mom, how did this happen? Who would ever thought Jake Schmaltz was a heroin addict?" This can happen to anyone. It does not discriminate. If Jake could have known the dangers this drug was, he never would have tried it. I've heard that from many people over the last 5 years. They didn't know the dangers and how addictive opiates are. So this is why it's so important to get education in the schools at an early age and continue to 12th grade. We have to save our youth from trying these evil drugs that destroy families and communities. Jake told us once that he wanted to be a teacher. Maybe this is his way of teaching us all a very good lesson. So I'm asking you to please vote yes, move this forward, save our children and our communities. And thank you for letting me testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Schmaltz. And I'm sure I speak for the entire committee when I say how very sorry we are on the loss of your son. And thank you for finding the ability to try to help others who may be facing this terrible addiction. So thank you for being here. Whoever wants to go next.
Hi, Chair Loon and members of the committee. My name is Bailey Belter, and I'm a staff of the Minnesota Youth Council. The Minnesota Youth Council is the official youth voice to the state government here in Minnesota, as you may know. And in fact, there's no other state with a group like this one, so we're pretty unique here. And I just want to give a shout out to Representative Marquardt for helping get us official in 2013. I'm speaking on behalf of youth members, as they are obviously in school right now and can't make it. However, one of our youth members named Jacob Just from way up in Morris, Minnesota, wrote a letter, and I submitted it to the record. So I encourage you to take some time to read it at some point today. He's a very thoughtful young man. Youth members of the Minnesota Youth Council voted in overwhelming support of House File 3361 relating to opioid education, which was created by the For Jake's Sake Foundation. Our group had the privilege of meeting Sherry, Jake's mom, and hearing their story of how opioids affected their life and loved ones. Both metro and rural students connected to this bill, especially those in Bemidji, Wilmer, and Morris, as you'll read in Jacob's letter. I was personally surprised by how many in our group had been touched by someone with an opioid addiction. Some had even lost a loved one from it. Our students had no idea that just one hit could take their life. They didn't know it was so much more potent than other drugs, and in fact, many hadn't even talked about it in school. And if some of them did talk about it in school, they felt like the drugs didn't get enough time or they didn't get enough information about it. So the young people want to talk about these hard things, and we must not shy away but actually do the opposite and lean into having tough conversations so the students can not only learn but feel safe and comfortable talking about an issue like this that often goes not talked about but are very obviously affecting their peers and their community. If we have learned anything from the past few weeks, it's that young people want change and are willing to let us know despite some pretty uneven power dynamics. It's our job as adults in positions of power now to decide if we want to put a stop to preventable deaths that affect so many communities across the state and ultimately our young people. The Minnesota Youth Council supports House File 3361 and urges this body to pass this measure. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Walter. And welcome.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Carla Peterson, and I'm with the For Jake's Sake Foundation. I would like to thank you for giving us this opportunity to testify today. Opiate use and abuse is of great concern to me, and I'm excited that the passing of Jake's Law can address this local epidemic by getting comprehensive, evidence-based substance misuse prevention curriculum into Minnesota's primary and secondary educational systems. Children need to be educated on the dangers of drugs in general, but especially when it within the topic of prescription medications, opiates, and heroin. Our children are not being informed about the highly toxic ramifications of experimenting with these types of drugs. The highest demographic abusing and overdosing on opiates are the 18 to 25-year-olds. This alone should motivate us to realize we are not doing enough within our primary and secondary educational systems. Every day, 4,000 teens between the ages of 12 and 17 try an illicit drug for the first time. We have heard a mother's story, Sherry, confirmed that her son did not know how powerful of a drug heroin could be. And we both have heard several parents that have stated that same sentiment. We, as caring and responsible adults, need to demonstrate our commitment to their safety and well-being. Jake's Law can begin to do this. Currently, Minnesota does not have state academic health education standards. Therefore, each school district can decide which curriculum to use, the intensity, and the frequency, creating a huge disparity in substance misuse instructional levels across our state. This is why we are here today to propose House File 3361 for your approval. SAMHSA, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, after years of research, concluded that the most successful drug prevention initiatives include starting early, having consistent messaging, and frequent conversations throughout a child's educational experience. This research analysis is a basic premise for our vision and our proposed law. Now, I'm not going to spend any more time really talking about the rationale as far as why we need better instruction to our kids, but I did share that with the education innovation policy, but I'm going to kind of move into just the nuts and bolts because I think that's why we're here today. So what is our game plan? First, we are going to create a statewide substance misuse K through 12 curriculum task force to develop a consistent approach to a comprehensive evidence-based substance misuse prevention initiative to be delivered throughout Minnesota within a few selected school districts during the 2018 and 2019 school year. This task force will be comprised of teachers, educational administrators, parents, and students, along with mental health, health care professionals, and state-level departmental staff. We heard from Bailey, our Minnesota Youth Council rep, how important youth voices are in the success of any initiative that impacts youth directly. Therefore, we will have a strong presence of youth on this task force. We want to formalize and administer at statewide assessments and evaluations, providing credible data that will resonate and be pertinent for all educators throughout Minnesota. We are proposing that we use a formal evaluator, maybe MDH or maybe like the Wilder Foundation. That hasn't been officially decided, but we would want to use some type of professional evaluator. This will alleviate some of the burden for classroom teachers to have them administer these assessments, have them administer these assessments. In addition, the final report will give us a credible analysis because we know that strict protocol was maintained during the execution of these assessments and evaluations. Due to the fact that time is of the essence, we're like 6 months out here before school is going to resume, we are proposing for the fall semester to utilize already top-notch identified curriculum from a variety of credible agencies such as SAMHSA, NIDA, NIH, DHS, Robert Crown Center, and streamline them to create an elementary through high school substance misuse package. For the fall, this will mean providing the curriculum, tools, and resources to teachers to instruct on an opiate family of drugs. Our vision is that maybe in June or so, we'll take 9 teachers, 3 for each of the grade bands, to create a fluid integration into not only within those grade bands, but also between the grade bands. So once they've worked separately, they'll come together, and we'll have some fluidity between the 5th through 12th grade instruction. I have been meeting with ISD 11 health education teachers for the past 3 months, and they have assisted with identifying the learning targets highlighted on the sheets with the grade bands listed, and I believe you do have that sheet that was handed out to you. It's this one. It's kind of a worksheet for us, but we'll give you an idea of what we are looking at. They felt that these targets would most likely be pretty close to what teachers could achieve within their designated units and time limits throughout the state of Minnesota. They thought we should give teachers some options to different formats. So there are a combination of PowerPoint presentations with worksheets, videos, online interactive lessons, case studies for group interactions, just to name a few. All of the learning targets are in alignment with the Minnesota Health Education Standards, which is the CDC's National Health Education Standards. And so we know their age, and so you don't have the sheet, but we did make sure that they're in alignment. And on the bottom of the sheet, you will see they're listed below, learning targets. One of the curriculums that we are using as pretty much our major foundational piece is the Robert Crown Center for Health Education Curriculum Overview. This curriculum is definitely the cornerstone to our overall approach. It was heavily vetted through the Robert Wood Foundation and the Iowa Consortium for Substance Abuse Research and Evaluation. It meets the CDC's National Health Education Standards, and the state of Illinois and Ohio have both adopted it. There is an executive summary. I can get this to the chair if you'd like to pass it to your other members. But it was based out of Chicago, and they did 11 different school districts, and they worked on it over a few years of study. And so this is what we're using, and that's why it's evidence-based. We know it works. We have the data, and that's why we would like to introduce it into Minnesota school districts as part of our choices. In your packets, you do have the science behind drugs. This is the Robert Crown Center. Some of the curriculum, it's on their website. And so you will see what their goals are. They have a very strong parent component as well. And that we feel is extremely important, that we're not just talking to the students, but we're talking to the parents, we're talking to the coaches, we're talking to the staff within the schools, so that they're getting the frequent conversations, they're getting the frequent messaging that the SAMHSA has defined as being important. In your packet, or handouts as well, you'll see that there was a proposed timeline for completion of the grant deliverables. Due to the timing that we're 6 months out, it is a little tight, but it will give you an idea of how we're envisioning things to occur in order for us to be ready to jumpstart this in the fall. And then, we are hoping to pilot this initiative in 250 school districts. And based on what I think we're around, 543 school districts or so, it's almost 50%. So we feel like we're going to be able to get a good representation of whether this curriculum is going to be effective in impacting our students as far as eradicating teenage drug use. Also, you're given the budget, and I think we'll move into the budget at this point in time. Madam Chairman, you can give me a little bit of direction. Do you want me to explain this, or do I open up for questions and ask people?
Well, I think, maybe if we open it up to questions at this point, I think maybe good. I mean, I have a sense, the committee has a sense of kind of the type of programming you're looking at for the schools, and obviously you've done a lot, the foundation's done a lot of work on the curriculum and accessing research that's been done and things that have been tested. I guess just one quick question for me before we turn it over to other members is, obviously, rolling this out for the school year to start this fall would be a pretty tight turnaround time. I'm wondering if you have any feedback from schools on whether or not they think, if this bill were to pass, and most bills are, August 1st enactment date, if they would be able to accommodate that for their plans for the fall school year.
Well, we would need to be proactive. And we really feel like in April, actually, we need to be starting to identify our potential partners and the teachers that are willing to commit to this so that we are ready in August to give them the materials. Based on the ISD 11 teachers' perspective, they felt like it, adding 1 or 2 days to their current time commitment is not overwhelming at this point. So they felt like, yes, the assessments were a concern of theirs, and that's why we were recommending to go with a outside evaluator so we can remove that from their plate. Also, we talked about, getting in 5th, 6th, 8th, 10th, 12th. We need it throughout that time period, because most kids, if they're only getting in 6th and 8th and, you know, in 10th grade, it might be an elective at that point and stuff. They're only getting maybe 2.5 hours of instructional time throughout a 6-year period of time. And so, you know, we're trying to close that gap. So it will also be not only health teachers, but we're hoping to incorporate into the sciences and social studies areas as well, so that it gets dispersed. So in 7th grade, you might hear it in the sciences. 8th grade, you might hear it in health, you know, to alleviate the burden.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Peterson. Other questions from the committee members for the testifiers or for the bill author? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, in policy, we're discussing right now that implementation date, or effective date, I should say. And I think from what I'm hearing, we're going to have to move it to the next school year. Certainly the legwork can be done, but for schools to prepare to do this across the state, I think you're going to have to expect that it'll be the 1920 school year.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson.
Ms. Peterson.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson. I guess then I'm curious, what are you proposing, that we table this and bring it up, or we just approve it to go into a longer time frame? I guess I'm a little confused on that.
Representative Erickson.
Madam Chair, well, in policy, we're working with the other part of the proposal that Representative Konish-Pradeen brought forward. So I think that's the section of embedding it in the health curriculum that we think is necessary to wait until 1920 to give teachers and schools a chance to digest this and figure it out. Otherwise, I think you should continue with what you're doing and with the financial piece that's in this committee. So I think you'll work that out with Representative Balloon, and Representative Konish-Pradeen and I will work on the other part. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Dabney?
No,
ma'am. All right, not seeing any. Is there anyone else from the general public who wishes to testify on House File 3361? All right, Representative Konish-Pradeen, would you like to make any final comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members, and all of you for taking the time to listen to this this story of Sherry and where she's taken it on behalf of her son. This is, I feel like a really important topic that we need to be discussing in our schools throughout the different grade levels and the different age levels. And I would just ask that for your support and your approval as we continue this mission to address the addiction that our families are dealing with across the state. So thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And thank you to the testifiers, and especially you, Mrs. Smosh. It's really, really good for you to be here and to share your story with others. And to all the testifiers, the Youth Council is amazing. They are a very tough group. I think I presented a bill before them a couple of years ago, and they asked very direct probing questions. So I'm glad that they're engaged in this issue as well. So for my previous motion today, I'm going to lay the bill over, but I really think this is something for the committee to give some thought to once we get a target and get down to putting numbers on a spreadsheet. So thank you very much for being
here.
All right, Representative Dean. All right, if you want to come forward, Representative Moran was not able to be here today, and so Representative Dean has kindly offered to present one of her bills. And so I will go ahead and move while he's getting situated. House File 3585. Be referred to Ways and Means. The chair's intention today is to lay the bill over for inclusion in an omnibus bill or further action a later time. And just so people know, this is the Girls in Action bill. Anyone who was around in 2016, we did provide a grant in our supplemental bill that year. So welcome, Representative Dean. Glad you could be with us today.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. And as you mentioned, I'm pitching for Representative Moran today. And I hope I do what Kirk Gibson did in the first game of the World Series in 1988 when he came out of the dugout to hit a home run and win the game. So we'll see how it goes today. What's that? Yeah. He hit the home run.
Pinch hitting, not pitching.
Yes. House File 385 is somewhat a simple bill, but it deals with some very complex issues and things in different segments of the community. And as you mentioned, Girls in Action have been doing work for quite some time, actually since 2005. I believe over 3,500 girls have been serviced and been engaged in their program, and currently I believe there's 300 girls, of which 92% are girls from color from challenging social, economic families and situations. And in the 2016 funding was really critical. It allowed them to expand their programs to nearly three times the sites in which they had currently been expanding some school-based programs, and they've moved into things around STEM literacy, so young women are getting opportunities to think about other things in careers that they hadn't been thinking about, and it's really that exposure to other pathways that are helping these young women succeed, inspired to go to college and to do those types of things. So one other thing, though, in the wake of the Me Too movement and the truth-telling that's been happening around that, I think that some young women are at a different place and feeling that there's shared experiences that they have and there's more conversation. And I think that these types of experiences are the types of things that will help these young women actually succeed. And with me today is Dr. Werner Price, who will be speaking more specifically about how the previous money has been used and about how the current funding they're seeking will be used moving forward. So, Dr. Price?
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Representative Dean, Representative Moran, who's not in the in the room right now, but is a great supporter of the work, and we stayed in touch with her very closely as we've done this work and expanded. And Madam Chair and the entire committee, thanks for having us back. I really appreciate it. A couple of things. You have our report. We spent quite a bit of time on this to make sure that you knew what we did and were accountable to those dollars. We've done a lot. And with that, we have worked really tirelessly over these 2 years to really get the program to as many schools and sites. We go where we're celebrated and not where we're tolerated. And what that basically means is that I will never knock down a school door to get Girls in Action. So really, schools call us, and they have been calling us like wild, more and more and more from across the Twin City metro area. As a matter of fact, tomorrow we launch a pilot in Osseo area schools with Maple Grove Middle and Senior High School, who called and said, you know, we really need more women of color and people of color and more diversity, and we really need our girls of color to really have more positive role models, and there are things going on that they need to talk about, and Girls in Action really gives them that space and that place to think and talk about those things that are really important to them. Bottom line for us, though, is that we have got to get our girls, particularly our girls of color, across the graduation line, and we have got to get them to college. And in our 2 years here, we have a 90% graduation rate, and 80% of our girls are in college as we speak. Of course, the girls that speak, you know, what speaks best to Girls in Action is really the girls themselves. So, of course, I've asked a couple of our girls here to just come and say what Girls in Action means to them. You need to know that one of the really wonderful things about the funding that you provided for us was to open up what's called community-based chapters. And so these are not school-specific. This is any girl from anywhere, and we were able to provide community-based chapters to four very distinct populations. We have an Asian American chapter that's led by Ms. Cabo. Yang over here, and I was at my first Hmong wedding on Saturday, and sure enough, who greeted me at the door but our girls and Girls in Action, who were there helping to support and helping to serve in their community. And, you know, of course, they couldn't miss me. I mean, it was just like, I walked in and they all went, and who was that lady? Like, I know those girls. Those are our girls, Girls in Action girls. And then we also enhanced all of our programs too, and I have Nancita Chakran here, who brought health and wellness to our girls, to just to breathe and to learn how to really take care of themselves, as opposed to just jumping into that fight or jumping into the argument. Breathe a little bit, right? And of course, Miss Natalie Johnson Lee is still with us and working it out and getting on. She's a master's getter across the line with our girls for seniors. It's amazing how she gets those girls across that line into college. So we have two of our girls here today just to say what Girls in Action means to them, and we'll open it up for questions. Everything about what we did, we're really articulate about it in our report, so we open up for questions. We have Miss Faisa. Miss Faisa's been in the country now for what, 2 years? Come on over. And she told me her journey on the way over here, and it's quite a journey. Come on over, Faisa. And she's in our Somali chapter, Girls in Action Community chapter, and she attends Lincoln International High School.
All right.
She's kind of shy, but not really. She chatted away once I got her that McDonald's strawberry shake.
Okay. Very good. Very good. Well, we're so glad you're here today. Can you tell us your name? And you can just tell us whatever you'd like to about the program. And
hi, I'm Faisa. I'm the student of, I don't know, okay.
You wrote it down. You can do it. You even wrote it down on your iPad.
I know, but
you can do it.
Okay. Let me go again. Hi, I'm Faisa, and today, I don't know, Miss Brenda bring me here to say, like, why I like this group. I like this group because it helps girls when they're growing, like, it helps us know the difference between when a girl is young and when she is big, when she grows, like, the difference, you know, women's know, just women. I don't think men know. So, we were learning like that, and I guess we did a lot of activities. Some are about girls, and some are for fun, to make people, like, comfortable, to not be shy, but I'm still shy because I never speak in front of people like you guys. So I don't know, this is my first time, so sorry.
You are doing great.
Are you glad Girls in Action is in your school and with your friends in the Somali community?
Yeah, because, like, it feels like Girls in Action are helping us. It's not just me. It's like every girl. So I guess Girls in Action, it's not useless. It's good for, I don't know, it's good that they came to our school, because a lot of good girls have changed, and I think I learned a lot of things from that Girls in Action.
Thank you.
So I think.
Great. Good job, Faisa. You did really well. Thank you so much for being here.
Then we have Kai, who is a senior at Cooper High School, which is one of our new expansion schools.
All right. So, hi. Thank you guys for having me today. My name is Kai Abunthe. I am a senior at Cooper High School. So you guys probably heard of me because we won state. So go on.
Yes, we did. Congratulations.
So, I would like to say the first time I've heard about Girls in Action this year is my first year even being a part of this group. I had a friend that reached out to me. She's been a part of this group for 3 years, and I never heard of it. I never thought I'd be able to join it, and this year was the year I finally had to come. I never knew who Dr. Vernon was until I read her book, and she came into class, and I was like, oh my gosh, you're the face on the back of this book.
That one lady.
Yeah. So reading from her book, I felt like this lady knew who I was. I felt like this lady was talking as if she was, like, right next to me from reading her book. And when I went to the first group of Girls in Action, I never felt, never went to a group that helped me feel very superior to who I was. She and in that group, there were other ladies who I saw were perfect role models. They showed what beauty, like, as a successful black lady even looked like. And during that group, we have girls from different ages that can bond together, so we don't have to show our differences of age or body size or beauty. We all talked at the same level. We all talked at the same pace to understand what we all mean. And being a Girls in Action, I felt as if it was a place for me to become a stress relief, to talk about what is life like as a girl, to know how do we make us girls, like, more beautiful? How do we make ourselves to even bring ourselves up from our insecurities? So from being in this group, I would have to say it was one of the best groups I ever joined. It helped me to know I can love myself, that I have power, I am valuable, and I am perfect the way I am. So I love this group, so if you guys do not give us money. and lastly, since this is my senior year, I will be attending Augsburg University. So I also would offer free tuition. So, yeah, and also that school, you guys know that school. Yeah. So, yeah. So,
yeah, high five that. That's awesome.
All right, thank you, guys.
Thank you so much. Kai, right?
Thank you, Kai.
Thank you. Great job. Do you have other testifiers?
We're good. Miss Natalie, you can come and say a few words, of course. Miss Natalie knows how to do this thing. She's my coach, actually.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. I've actually been with Girls in Action for 13 years. I've been with them when they had no dollars, I had them when they little girl dollars, and I had them when they had a few dollars. One of the things that they say is they say, do the things that you love. And so this is a program that I love. I have walked many girls across the stage. One of the things that we're talking about is how I get the girls across the stage. And that's not always an easy feat. It takes a lot of work, takes a lot of grit. Takes a lot of connection with parents and getting parents to understand. A lot of times what happens in our communities is the parents think college tuition is not within their reach. And as we begin to talk to them and work with them and encourage them and give them different tools, and we also work with the girls so that the girls can enroll in college and the parents feel comfortable. So we've got girls, you know, in state, out of state, all over in college. And so and all of our young girls show up in very strong leadership skills. They serve as strong leaders. And many of our girls now, we're at the stage now where our girls are now coming back. They have graduated from college and they're coming back and they're actually working and volunteering for the program. So we're seeing the full circle come back around. So that's a good thing as well, too. So that's something to I want to make sure that you know that they also come back and they call us and say, how can I give back for what we received? And so we also, not only do we get them in college, we see them through college. So we don't just get them to the door of college and hand them off, but we make sure that they are being successful so that they actually graduate from college as well.
All right, thank you. I'm sorry, could you say your name again for the record?
Natalie Johnson Lee.
Thank you very much, Ms. Lee. We get that. All right. I've got some questions. Representative Bennett and then Representative Murphy. Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. These are very noisy microphones. Thank you so much for being here. It's interesting to hear about your program. Could you share a little bit about how your girls are recruited? Do they come just kind of self-initiated? Is it something where you target young women who you can see are on the wrong road, are displaying behaviors that maybe you can see are going to lead to things that aren't so good? How do you recruit your young women?
Dr. Price.
Any girl who wants to be in Girls in Action can be in Girls in Action. We typically open up to girls in schools, and we get the information out to them. And any girl who, I always, it's my hoochie mama to Harvard analogy, right? So any girl who thinks she wants to be a Lucci mama, to every girl who has an academic scholarship to Harvard, it doesn't matter to us. It doesn't matter her GPA, doesn't matter who her parents are or not. We just want to know whether she wants women to help her get to her next level. So any girl. Sometimes, of course, schools will recommend a girl. And we take the recommendations, but we ask that they not mandate any girl into Girls in Action. We want the girls to come on their own.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to know then, when you get them to the door of the college, and then how do you or do you influence the courses that they might take or the fields that they might go into and that they might become teachers and they might become intimately involved in the education process in future years?
So one of the things I would say, Madam Chair and Representative Murphy, one of the things I would say to you, that is a great question. Some of our, we actually have two of our young ladies right now that I know are going to be, they're going to school to be teachers. This is a challenge. They must have a good, positive relationship with the teacher to desire to actually want to go in that career. Or they could have an adverse relationship with the teacher that makes them want to come back and correct the system. So a lot of that also depends on their experience with teachers in the school. But we give them access to women in many fields, in many areas of opportunity. So they have a wide variety that they can choose from. We put examples in front of them every year on a yearly basis, and so they can choose. But yeah, we do have some of our students are coming back to be educators.
Good. Thank you, Madam Chair. And one more question. I'm not familiar with the term hoochie mama. So could you explain, please?
I think we only it's a 10 second, right? Oh man. So hoochie mama is a girl who somehow thinks that she just wants to, she forgot that Victoria had secrets, or she used to, and it's just all going on, and she is doing as such in her school. So she comes to school dressed in like she's part stripper. And now let me just say that when she walks into Girls in Action and she looks like she wants to be a hoochie mama, it doesn't matter to us, because we'll take her anyway, because we know what the end result is. So when it's all said and done, we know that she's going to work through that. She's going to, you know, kind of understand who she really is from her own personal power, and she's going to learn her own value, and she's going to make that adjustment. So we tell the girls, you know, I don't care how you come, just come, because I know what the end result is going to be. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Other questions? Oh, Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know what a hoochie mama is.
I do too now.
Yeah. I used to teach at Franklin, and you weren't at Franklin when I was there, because it was about 20 years ago.
Oh.
Quite a while ago. Anyway, what a wonderful program.
Thank you.
I love it. I was going to ask you, my experience has been with kids that that would receive Wallen scholarships, full rides to whatever college they wanted to go to. And there were a significant number of kids who just, they were sort of just set free, and it was very difficult for them to, as a first generation high school probably, but also college, to get a grip on what college was about and stuff. What kinds of mentoring do you do with the girls as they go on to post-secondary?
This is good. First of all, we just stay in touch with them, and we tell them that when you go to college, you're still in Girls in Action, and that we expect them to stay in touch with us. Now, realizing that most of our girls, 80% of our girls, are first-year you know, generation college students. So no one in their families knows what even going to college really even means. And so we really kind of walk them through. Here's how this works. Here's how this works. Here's how this works. And it's important that we put so much work into them that we don't want them to get to that first year of college and then just lose it. And sometimes they do try to lose it. And then sometimes Ms. Natalie has had to make some personal road trips down to the colleges to have a conversation because no one else will do it. We put them on buses and sent them back to college. We've taken them back to college because someone in their family got shot and they want to come home. And then everyone wants them to stay home and then start working. Like, no, go back. The best thing you can do for your family when you come from a generational poverty family is get in college, get an education, and try to change that trajectory for yourself and for your family. Not easy, but we do it.
Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Do you know what a hootsie is? Sorry. I'm just having fun over here.
All right. Not seeing any other questions. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Clayton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for what you do, and what a great program. So my question on this, and I fully support this, but my question is, these students walk by many, many adults throughout the day in the schools. And you know, what you're doing is, you know, as I think of the kinships or the boys club, I mean, we're focusing on these kids of need. But why, and I don't know if you can answer this, but why are these kids walking by so many adults and that mentorship component is being missed?
So, Madam Chair and committee members, so let me just give you an example. I can follow the life of a student in a day, and in some of the schools, the students don't even get hellos during the day. But one of the things that we work with the students to do, so let me give you an example. So girl A is in group having a conversation, talking to me about something that she said to her teacher, which I believe is inappropriate. So after group, me and girl A have a conversation. Me and girl A go back to the teacher, whether she likes the teacher or not, and she has to address the teacher, apologize, and then figure out what they need to do to have a better relationship. All right? In doing that particular piece, what I find out is girl A is having challenges in multiple classes. So now I am walking girl A from teacher to teacher to teacher to have this conversation, to begin to have, so she can have better relationships. This particular young woman I'm speaking of, I've done it many times, but I've talked about one particular student, was a D-minus student, but graduated with, I think, her GPA was probably about a 1, almost a 2 point, but by the time she graduated and we got her grades up, she graduated at like a 2.8, which was a significant jump from where she was. But when she graduated, she had all B's, A's and B's. From us teaching her how to build relationships with her teacher, not necessarily teaching the teachers how to build relationships with the kids. Some teachers we can do that with. Some teachers some students we just need to teach them how to navigate and how to get what they need while they're in high school so they can get out and do better. And then that's where we encourage them, if they want to change the system, to come back and be an educator and come back. So that's how that would work. But and then also, in some cases, it depends on the teacher, it depends on the school, it depends on what's happening in the classroom. And so they may walk by many, many, many teachers, but I don't know that teachers have the luxury anymore of mentoring kids like they used to. So therefore, you've got to have, they've got to have support and help.
Representative Krishna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so you hit it right there. I want to understand, why don't teachers have the luxury anymore? And when I was in the schools and for the many years I taught, the kid, you knew these kids as they were going through, and we had a room of Vine and the teachers, and we knew what was going on. If I was coaching a kid after school or whatever, I knew by the time that kid hit me all the things that had happened throughout that day. And I was asking about the family, the home life. So why don't teachers have the luxury? What have we lost that, and I don't know that we can answer that, but that's concerning to me.
You got too many kids in the classroom. You got the classrooms are there's way too many kids in the classroom.
And some teachers can manage it, but those are the very few and exceptional. But right now, yeah, you have way too many kids in the classrooms.
Representative Crisha.
Maybe. I mean, I can deal with 250 kids a day. And I'm not saying that that's not the problem, but I just think we have to keep looking. And
And can I say one other thing, too?
Dr. Price.
Oh, thank you. Is that the dynamic has changed a bit between teacher and students. And unfortunately, there are some teachers that are afraid of their students, and they're not having those conversations like they used to anymore. And there are some teachers who are just plain old tired, and they really are having a hard time bearing that, because when you mentor a student, you mm-hmm. take their family with you, they take them with you. And so I think that there's a lot of other dynamics, social media in schools, dynamics, cell phones in schools. There's so many dynamics going on that are kind of interfering, I think, with that part of mentoring that I agree should be happening and could be happening. I think what Girls in Action helps our teachers to do is support them in that. And some of them, we give them the courage again to mentor their students again as they see us do it.
Thank you. Representative Krishna.
Thank you. Thank you for articulating that. And I don't think there's blame here. I just think there's a why. I'm trying to, I can go, you're right, there are, the numbers in classrooms can be very unwieldy and all this, but I want to go back to what you just articulated, and that I'm trying to understand is, why have the relationships changed on what we used to do? Because you're right. There are still kids that I come across from my teaching days that I carried the burdens of those family frustrations or challenges, and you still ask about them.
Yep.
And so that's the question I want to understand is why the relationships have changed from when we used to be able to put our hand on a kid's shoulder and walk them down a path of, you know what, this isn't the right spot, let's look at these alternatives. And so I applaud you for what you're doing, and thank you, but I'm also trying to understand why that relationships continue to change.
Thank you. Members, this is a great topic, and we could talk a lot longer, but I do want to get to Representative Dabney-Sville because he's got a lot of testifiers here. Thank you so much for being here, Dr. Price, Ms. Lee, especially to our students. You did really well, and we're really always pleased to have you. And Representative Dean, thank you for, you did a great job pinch hitting.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just encourage the support of Girls in Action. The work they've done has been amazing, and I just have to call out a fellow Hawk. I graduated from Cooper a long, long time ago, too, so good things for her and her future.
Yeah,
thank you, Madam Chair.
Awesome. All right. Well, with that, I'm going to renew my motion, and House File 3585 is laid over for possible inclusion, and thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it. Representative Dabney. And Representative Mariani, I know you're prepared to present Representative Moran's other bill. We are probably going to have to push that to Thursday, if that works for you. Okay.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 2645 to be before the committee.
All right. Representative Dabney, House File 2645, we refer to Committee on Ways and Means. So today, my intention is to lay it over for possible inclusion or further action. And then you do have an amendment as well, Representative Dabney. Did you want to move that to get the bill in the shape you would like?
Thank you very much. I'd like to move the H2645A1 amendment to be before the committee. And as you stated, it's to get the bill in the order. I appreciate it.
All right, and so any questions on the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, the A1 amendment is incorporated to House File 2645. Representative Dabney.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm very pleased to be here today to present this bill before the committee. The bill requests support for Project Success to deepen and expand its work using the arts to engage students. And once engaged, it uses the relationships that they build over time to motivate and inspire students to explore themselves, to set goals, to establish aspirations, touch their dreams, and even to explore the Boundary Waters canoe area. Project Success's tagline is Dreams to Action, and through its programming, it sustains ongoing relationships with students from middle school through high school, And that persistence pays off in measurable ways. I think that maybe a great way to introduce the mission and work of this organization is through the video that Caitlin has queued up here. So I'd urge people to attend to the screens. Madam Chair, I really like that video.
Thank you.
And I think what you saw there were high production values. And that is also a reflection of the standards to which Project Success as an organization and individual staff hold themselves. And so I thought it was not only a good reflection of what they do, but also how they do their work. With me today, I trust we're going to lead off with Adrian Dirks, the founder and executive director.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Dabney. Thank you very much, all of you, for having us. My name is Adrian Dirks, and I'm Executive Director and Founder of Project Success. We are 24 years old and began at North High and Franklin Middle School many, many years ago. Our mission has not changed, as you could tell by the video. It is to inspire young people to dream about their future, but also help them take steps and achieve goals to get there. And it's also to give them the tools that will take them through the rest of their lives. I'm a Minneapolis Public Schools grad, went all the way K through 12 in Minneapolis. And one of the reasons I'm still here today and so honored to be here, some people say, especially young people, you've been here 24 years. I started when I was 10. But one of the reasons I'm still here is that I received a call this week, and I bring this up because it was a student who I met 20 years ago at Franklin Middle School and then at North High School who called me out of the blue. She is now the CEO of United Way in South Dakota. And out of the blue, I picked up the number, and she said with tears, I just have to tell you that Project Success is still helping me today, and I just got a really incredible job in northern Minnesota, and you changed my life and my trajectory, and that's why we're here today. We have many stories like that. So Project Success works. We have two, especially after 24 years, it's important we look at, we serve 13,000 students a year currently. We have been growing. We serve students 6th through 12th grade in 19 Minneapolis public schools. One thing that people find hard to even fathom is that we work with every single student in those 19 schools. We don't say one student needs it but another doesn't. That being said, in the Minneapolis public schools, over 70% of our students qualify for free and reduced lunch. So we've been growing in those 24 years. As I said, it is a program that works. We have two incredible partners that help us measure our success. One of them is the University of Minnesota and the Center for Applied Research, or CARI. We've been doing studies with them since practically the beginning, and they continue to be a partner today. The other critical partner, of course, is the Minneapolis Public Schools and REAA, and they are a critical partner for us. Eric Moore, who is the chief in Minneapolis and runs REAA, has been an incredible partner over the last 4 years. We have kept data both from that green spreadsheet, remember the green lines, 24 years ago we kept that spreadsheet and then have built databases since then. So 4 years ago we brought that information to Eric Moore and said to him, handed the flash drive and said, this is data for tens of thousands of students and we want to know what impact we're having with critical markers such as on-time graduation, attendance, and one thing he really wanted to see was GPA. As he said, that was the greatest predictor of success. We have, and we've included that in our packet, statistically significant impact on students, not just, as Eric Moore said, one time, but year over year, and especially in GPA. We are so honored to be here today in requesting this money, and I just want to say that our strategic plan currently says two things for our big goal in the center, which is we not only want to deepen our impact for the current students and families that we're serving, but we want to double our impact. And we've been doing that. Over the last several years, we've added three more schools. We've added global experiences and great trips. We think experiences have an incredible impact. We just got back from taking over 50 students to the African American Museum in D.C. along with a college tour to Howard. And we leave soon with almost 100 high school students to Chicago to see over 10 campuses. So the funding would mean that we could not only deepen our impact and our experiences, but add more students and more schools. There's not a better way to hear about and learn about Project Success than through the eyes and words of a student, so I'm thrilled to turn it over to Alejandro, who will tell you more about Project Success and is a high school senior in Minneapolis, a high school student junior in Minneapolis.
Madam Chair, representatives, thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Alejandro Duarte. I'm an 11th grader at Edison High School in Minneapolis, and I've been a part of Project Success since my 6th grade year at Marcy Middle School. Over my years of being in Project Success, I've been able to be a part of 44 workshops during my English classes, where we discuss our futures, our dreams, what we're interested in college, and our future path beyond secondary education. I've been able to go on 4 different college tours with my community from my school, which have really been some of the most memorable college tours I've been on, being able to be with your community that you've built at school and through Project Success is really enlightening, especially when thinking about the future, knowing that you have people to hold on to. I've been a part of 20 live professional theater productions, been able to go see all of those with no cost to me, either on a field trip or on a weekend with my family, all thanks to Project Success. And finally, I've been part of 2 middle school productions when I was at Marcy, where I was able to build community and develop my own artistic voice, and which leads me to now identifying as a theater artist and a writer. Project Success has really always been a constant in my life as far as I can remember through middle school. And one of the biggest parts of that is having our in-class facilitator. In my case, it's Haley at Edison. And even when she is not leading a workshop in my English class, I see her around almost every week. And so just to have that for myself is really important, to know that in the midst of the changes in our school and the changes in our student body and the changes in our lives as young people, that we have a grounding force whose job is to help us get to the future, and think about that there is not just one path to finding where we best want to go in life. One of the most impactful parts of my Project Success experience was 3 years ago I was part of a piece that Project Success commissioned called And So I Did, which was an original piece that myself and 10 other students wrote. And we were able to tour that piece in St. Paul Public High Schools, and then we were also, as part of the first major global experience of Project Success, able to go to Cuernavaca, Morelos in Mexico and tour that for high school students there. And that was a really impactful experience, getting to see my words and my peers' words on a global stage, and understand that our words have power, and that we, as young people in the United States, have intercultural communication across international lines. And so that's something that I'll always reference back to in my work as a human being. If Project Success didn't exist in my K-12 experience, my peers and I know wouldn't have had access to all of these opportunities for college tours and workshops that are outside of the academic realm, but that are still rooted in the school community, so there's a lot of access. And then we also wouldn't have the time and space to have grounded conversation about our futures that wasn't for a grade. Nothing in Project Success is for a grade. It's for support from the community, from the facilitators, from people like Adrian. And 90% of Project Success students report that they are more motivated as a result of the program, and I am one of those students. My dream now, that I can say confidently, is to go to a four-year college and study theater and film, and that is a dream that I was able to come up with because of Project Success. And so I would ask you to please consider funding this program that has had a life-changing impact for myself, and I know for as many of my peers. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Alejandro. It's great to have you work with us. Do you have another testifier? Is there someone else who wants to talk?
We don't. We have wonderful Emily Hegel and Shamari Whitaker here in case there are questions. Emily's head of advancement, and Shamari Whitaker is our director of evaluation. So I wanted them both here.
Excellent. Excellent. Questions? Representative Sloan, or Slocum. Slocum, not Sloan.
Madam Chair, call me what you wish. thank you. Adrian, we worked together at Franklin about...
Yes, we did.
You're not nearly as old as I am, but we worked together, and I remember I took kids to the Penumbra. Yeah. That was the most monumental experience with them. Because you have lessons on how you behave at a theater because they'd never been before. The kids were like, we don't know what we're doing, you know. So you walk them through how you go in, how you sit down, how you have to be quiet. That's a big, big, you know, thing. And they were just wide-eyed when we left. And then we talked about the jobs at a theater. We talked about writing a play. We talked about, in fact, some kids I think did.
Mm-hmm.
I might have been teaching English then or social studies. I don't know. Anyway, and we talked about building sets. We talked about taking tickets. We talked about everything that had to do with a play. Advertising. We talked about all these different jobs that go with a play. Mm-hmm. The kids were wide-eyed and very excited. We had the best. That was my most memorable time. It's with Project Success. And I recognized you as you came up here and sat down and went, I worked with her like a bunch of years ago.
Yes.
We're not even going to go into how many. Thank you.
Thank you. One quick question I had. How many schools are you in currently? And then if you were able to get this grant, how many, you said you'd be able to expand to the number of schools?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We are currently in 19 schools and serving over 13,000 students and their families. And I always think of that, and their families are such a critical part of what we do. So I think of it as nearly 50,000 people in Minneapolis, which is incredible. We have 5 more schools, basically, in Minneapolis to serve where we would serve nearly every 6th through 12th grader in the Minneapolis Public Schools and their families, which is our dream and what we're working towards and our goal. We also, part of that, a very critical piece of that goal and dream is that we work with every single Minneapolis 6th through 12th grade and their families, whether they're in a charter contract alternative. We recently added Wellstone International as well as Longfellow High School for Teen Moms. So approximately 5 is what we're looking to add in our current plan.
All right. Thank you. All right. We are over, which happens often in this debate, because we have the best, most interesting testifiers. So thank you, all of you. And my deep apologies to Representative Mariani and to your testifiers. We're not going to be able to get the bill in today that you're going to want to represent Moran's other bills, so we'll have to push that to Thursday. So, and my apologies for another day. But it's deadline week, and so we were maybe going to go later, but there are no rooms available tonight because everybody with a policy committee is meeting late. So with that, Representative Dabney, thank you so much for bringing the bill forward. And you renew your motion, and I'm laying the bill over today. But thanks so much for presenting this. I, full disclosure, my kids were theater kids, and that's how they found their friend group. You know, that's how they found their peers, and how a really large high school was made smaller for the kids. And I know for every kid, it's whatever your activity that you're interested in that helps. You know, where you find your friends. Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, you did a very savvy thing today with Representative, with the Jake's Law presentation and then Girls in Action in this, because it illustrates the balance that we ask schools to do, which is, yes, kids need targeted information on drugs, on alcohol, on sex, on tobacco, but we also need strategies that are about the whole child and strengthen that whole child who, if you look at the Search Institute's research, then becomes more resilient in delaying sexual activity, in avoiding drugs and alcohol and tobacco. And so a program like Project Success, yeah, it grabs them by the theater, but it strengthens the whole child, which helps them dream and achieve and stay on a path toward success.
Absolutely.
So thank you for that.
Absolutely. So. All right, thank you all so much. Great testimony, great presentations, and we are adjourned.